Hello, this is Bob Fisher, and I'm back with another issue of Talking Travel Literature. And as usual, I'm joined by my good friend, a fellow travel journalist, and a fellow Talking Travel journalist, Peter Flaherty. Good morning, Peter. How are you doing?
Good morning, Bob. I'm doing great. I'm looking forward to our discussion.
And so, why don't we just jump right in and tell the people, what's the book we're going to be talking about today, Peter?
Well, the book we're going to be talking about today is by Robert D. Kaplan, and it's called Mediterranean Winter, The Pleasures of History and Landscape in Tunisia, Sicily, Dalmatia, and the Peloponnese. It's a wonderful travel memoir. Kaplan's an excellent writer, and I really enjoyed reading this book, not just once, but twice.
Now, hang on, because you've got one copy of the book in your hand. I've got another copy of in my hand. My book is titled Mediterranean Winter, A Journey Through History. How come?
Two different editions, Bob. It's a good question, but I think my subtitle is actually better than yours because it gives the reader a much better idea of the specific places that Kaplan is talking about in his visit to the different parts of the Mediterranean. The three places he mainly talks about are Tunisia, Sicily, Dalmatia, which is the coastal part of Croatia, and the Peloponnese region of central mainland Greece. However, he does give some remarkable insights to some other places in the Mediterranean too, including Marseille and Rome. So it's not just restricted to those three areas.
But it is interesting how books are marketed, and when they're marketed in different editions or at different times, that the title can actually change. Okay, before we go any further, let's talk a little bit about Kaplan and give some background on Kaplan. Robert Kaplan, he is a correspondent with Atlantic Monthly. One writer has referred to him as America's premier traveler, a best-selling author, 8 books on foreign affairs and travel, Balkan Ghosts, The Ends of the Earth, The Coming Anarchy, Eastward to Tartary. He's also a senior fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington, but tell me a little bit more about him.
Well, I think that one of the things that really strikes me about, and I've read a few of his other books, is how he's kind of like, he's got his ear to the ground, and maybe to use another metaphor, he's got very sharp antennae about world events and crises in the making. For instance, he was in Kosovo at the time the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, and he really believed that what was happening in what was still then Yugoslavia would have a lot more impact on European and world events in a way than even the fall of the Berlin Wall. So he's a very sharp and astute journalist, and I think that because he's able to combine his travel writing sensibilities with commentary on political events, it really enriches his perspective and his insights.
And obviously history. And, of course, Mediterranean Winter is all about history. I found this book to be a very unique kind of memoir. And I say unique because it was a personal memoir that he wrote in the present time, but based on travels that he made in the 1970s when he was a young hotshot, out of work journalist, backpacking, rough and ready, around Europe. But it's a book that has incredibly rich prose. And for me, it was a vicarious travel experience as I went with him in his intellectual wandering and his journey through antiquity. Very reflective. But why the Mediterranean? Why is this the subject of the book?
I think that at the very beginning, he kind of gives some hints about that when he was growing up in Vermont and kind of bored with his surroundings and not really finding that he was getting much out of university. He basically stumbled across some books that had been written set in the Mediterranean, for instance, some writings of some novels by Flaubert and other 19th century writers, and that really inspired him to visit the Mediterranean. I mean, he is someone who is clearly fascinated, you might even say obsessed, by history, and I've been to the Mediterranean too, and you can't really find too many more places in the world where there are so many different layers and levels of history. I mean, he really gets right down to the very early periods of the Mediterranean and Sicily and Tunisia and shows how all the different civilizations from the Greeks and the Romans through the Arabs and the various European powers that have fought over this region have really left their mark. And you can just see those layers when you're visiting.
Okay, well, I'm going to show off my Latin a little bit here, okay. But as you and I recall from way back, the word Mediterranean Sea, Mediterranee, means the sea in the middle of land, and it was the inside sea. But it's also for him very much a metaphor for the evolution of human civilization. And I had mentioned that the prose is very rich, and I just want to start so that the listeners get a sense of how well this guy writes. And here's a quote that I absolutely loved, and I think this is when he was in Syracuse, the city of Syracuse on the island.
Right. What? Sicily. Not to be confused with Syracuse, New York. Right. Which is also a wonderful place.
Yes. Anyway, he says, and listen to this, shattered domes revealed clouds moving overhead in countless visions of eternity. It was a place made for silence and for contemplation, where you wanted a book handy. Every corner was a cloister. No view was panoramic. Each seemed deliberately composed. He's a highly articulate writer, very evocative. His style is lyrical, it's graceful, but it also is extremely personal. And he seems to be able to make us identify with the personal moment in travel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I found that so many times reading this book and rereading it. Actually, when you reread that quote to me, it occurred to me that I don't think it is Syracuse. I think he's talking about Hadrian's Villa.
Oh, you're right.
Which is a place I visited.
Right. Just outside Rome.
Just outside Rome, in Tivoli, right. Exactly. And when he says that it's a place where you kind of want a book handy, these kinds of insights that he makes in the book are just so remarkably personal and resonate so powerfully with me, because I was in Hadrian's Villa and sitting out in the Canopus, which is the place he's describing there, and I actually had a copy of the memoirs of Hadrian with me, which I'd bought at the bookstore at the villa and was reading it while I was sitting there on a beautiful Mediterranean afternoon. So he really is able to capture those moments, and you're right, his prose is to die for. I mean, all of us who struggle at travel writing could really learn a lot from the way he writes.
It's very much an educational book as well. And what I found that he's not so much looking inward on himself, navel-gazing, but he's looking outward and really on our behalf, mm-hmm, of the readers and all those interested in travel and history. And he's examining the depths of the learning process that is part and parcel of travel. And what I want to do now, Peter, is I'm just going to toss some concepts at you, some themes.
Okay.
And
I'll try to hit them back.
Okay. And so this is called the Robert Kaplan Mediterranean Winter Game.
Right.
Kaplan talks about momentary insight.
Mm-hmm.
Comment on that.
Well, I think the one that we just were discussing is a good example. I mean, when he says that, you know, it's the kind of place where you'd like to have a book handy, or he will capture the mood of a place just through a description of, I don't know, the way the birds were flying or the way the foliage smelt when he was there. I mean, he's really poetic in his ability to conjure up a sense of what a place is like. In the case that I was talking about, it was a place I'd visited, but even places like Tunisia that he describes, which I've never been to, I hope to someday, you get a really good idea of what they're like from the way he can just capture these moments through the richness of his prose.
Well, I hope the Tunisia CVB is listening, because we're ready for a media trip when they are.
For sure.
Okay, a universal civilization. At one point, I love this part too, he says, Marseille taught me that Mediterranean history was about power first, beauty second.
Right.
The artistic monuments I had seen in the Louvre, and that's where he, mm-hmm, started his, mm-hmm, trip, were the products of wealthy empires that mastered the hurly-burly of commerce and military strategy before they could produce great art. So, the Mediterranean and a universal civilization. Tell me about that.
I think what he means by that is that because of the Mediterranean is in the middle of all these different civilizations, it's been a place where they've encountered each other, sometimes violently, certainly through many of the wars, the Crusades being one example, and wars from ancient times that he talks about too, the Peloponnesian War, the Punic Wars. But at the same time, there's been, on the other side, a really rich exchange of civilization, of culture, of traditions, and there have been long periods of history, and I think this is something we need to remember these days with the problems that we're seeing in the world, that there have been times when the great civilizations, the Christian, the Muslim, the Jewish, have been able to live together in relative peace and harmony. And he's able to talk about, for instance, a place like Sicily that has seen so many invaders and occupiers come and go, but each one has left its mark, its trace, and you can still appreciate all these things today. For instance, I didn't know this, that couscous, which is a North African dish, is still probably one of the most popular things on the menu in Sicilian restaurants to this day, a mark of the Arab's presence there that lasted for centuries.
And of course, this is what he does in the book, too. He shows the fabric of civilization that was woven throughout the Mediterranean. And I like the fact that he points out that the Mediterranean became for humanity not just a single sea, but a series of smaller ones. For example, the Adriatic, the Aegean, the Tyrrhenian, mm-hmm. etc.
Ionian.
Mm-hmm. Ionian. And so it is the seas of civilization coming together. Okay, here's the next one. You ready? I'm going to pitch it to
okay.
you.
Okay.
The life of the mind. He talks about that.
The life of the Kaplan is nothing if not reflective, and you're right. He doesn't navel gaze, but he does allow himself to speculate on contemporary events through the prism or the lens of the place he's in and the period of history he's thinking about. One really good example is he talks about in the 70s, when shortly after the end of the war in Vietnam, he was in Sicily and he'd been reading Thucydides' account of the failed Athenian invasion of Sicily during the Peloponnesian War when Athens was fighting against Sparta, and the kind of the arrogance of empire and overconfidence and inability to see the real strategic objectives that led the Athenians to their downfall, you know, so many centuries ago in Sicily, really resonated with him when he was thinking about what his own country, the United States, had just been through in Vietnam only a few months before he was there. So I think he allows himself with the life of the mind to really show how the past can inform the present. It's not like the cliche that history, you know, repeats itself, but there certainly are some parallels that the study of history can teach us about today.
Okay, you've given me a great segue.
Good.
And for the next quote, and the quote is, "Hence, the primary meaning of history is that which I have seen and then known. The word idea also comes from this root. History that winter was something I saw before encountering it in books." But he's a writer.
He's a writer, and I guess it doesn't say too much for his teachers in high school and university. Having been a high school history teacher myself, I wish I'd had that quote earlier in my career. I mean, it is true, and I've found this in teaching, and I've taken students to Europe for summer courses and things like that. I really do think that people learn and appreciate more about history when they actually see the places where it's been made. Books are helpful, and Kaplan is a great reader, and in preparation for this book, I would really recommend his list of recommended readings is wonderfully complete and comprehensive, and you could really inform yourself a lot about, you could do a course on the Mediterranean just from his reading list, but first-hand experience is really more important.
So he's really talking about the experiential
right.
view of
mm-hmm.
history, and it's also important, and we have to repeat that he wrote this book, what, 20, 30 years after he actually made the trip?
That's right.
And I love this part, too. He talks about the Mediterranean echoing the sounds of chaos and divinity.
Mm-hmm.
Comment on the use of the terms chaos and divinity.
Well, they're wonderful terms, and they capture a lot of the history of the Mediterranean just in a couple of words. There have been centuries of chaos and the conflict of empires, and one, as I said, Sicily being a good example, one group coming in, fighting another, leaving their trace, moving on. I mean, there's been a lot of instability, but at the same time, divinity. This is, let's not forget, this is the birthplace, or close to it anyway, of three of the world's great religions. And when he talks about, for instance, the Orthodox monasteries in Mount Athos in Greece, you really do get a sense of divinity, of how it's possible to step from the 21st century in a way right back into the Middle Ages and immerse yourself in a religious culture that's still thriving today.
Something that surprised me in the book, though, he says at one point that journalism must sometimes be done silently. And here's a quote. "That winter, I acquired the habit of never using a camera. It forced me to work harder, writing down every detail. Photographs can be passive and reductive. They allow us to recall too easily, omitting from view what is behind the camera and to the sides of it. But at the same time, other times he says, don't even write it down. Just sit there. You know, why is he telling us to do that?
Well, I think that, you know, he's probably right about the camera. I know I'm not a great photographer, and I do sometimes find that the camera gets in my way. I may be in a wonderful place, and I keep thinking I should be taking pictures of this, but the act of getting the camera out, framing the picture, taking it really in a way does take you away from the direct experience that you're having. And as far as not writing things down, I think he's probably got a point there. What I have tried to train myself to do, unlike some travel journalists who sort of carry a notebook around with them wherever they go, is I try to remember things, and then perhaps when I get back to my hotel room at the end of the day in the evening, maybe just before going to sleep, I'll jot down a very skeletal list of the things and places I've seen that day and then go back to it later and flesh it out. But I really do think that to be a wonderful travel writer, like not just good, as Kaplan is, you have to develop a memory, and you have to have a very good memory. Now, he knows that his memory plays tricks on him, but it's clearly he remembers these things 30 years ago. I'm in awe of it.
And the other warning he gives us, and it goes along with that, is to beware of what he calls self-dramatization. And he refers to it as the sin of creating poignant memories in advance. Well, here we have the old story of you thinking you know a place before you even go there, you know.
That's right.
But he also says romance is the catalyst of a true education. Mm-hmm. Comment on his use of the word romance.
Well, I don't think he means it in the sort of traditional sense. He was traveling with a companion. He uses the first person plural we many times. I didn't get any sense at all who the person, I assume it was a woman who was traveling with, maybe not. Whether there was any romance between the two of them during this trip to the Mediterranean, which many people think of as a romantic destination, is not clear, but I think the romance he's having is with history and with the civilizations of the Mediterranean.
Right, and if we go back to the derivation of the word romance, the true meaning of it, which from the French, roman, mm-hmm. which means novel or narrative.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So really, the romance is the telling of the story, the
right.
retelling, and the engaging. Mm-hmm. He also says that fine distinctions and relativities are the essence of travel, and reminds us that comparison is the basis of sound analysis. What's the nature of the comparison he's doing in this book?
Well, he's certainly comparing the different places in the Mediterranean that he visits and shows how, you know, each one is unique in its own way, but at the same time shares features in common with this whole greater entity of Mediterranean civilization. I think he's also making comparisons between different periods of history, particularly our own, and the medieval era, and the clash between Christianity and Islam, or the ancient times when there were wars such as the ones between Rome and Carthage or the different Greek city-states. So he's making lots of very insightful comparisons, I think.
At one point, towards the end of the book, too, I think it gets a little bit didactic here.
He shows off his erudition.
Right.
Which we should all try to do, I suppose, but right. He's got a lot of it to show off.
But I felt as if my knuckles had been wrapped a little bit when he says the following: conditions for travel writing may have been more propitious than for another reason. He's talking about
the great
other
age.
Time, the great age, the great classical age.
Right.
He says, the absence of television and other electronic distractions gave those armed with classical educations more time to read and hone their intellects, allowing some of them to communicate their thoughts in a language particularly exquisite.
That's right.
I kind of think he's talking about himself.
He is, uh-huh.
But nonetheless, television and the Internet, etc., are certainly good tools. I'm not going to give it up. Can we just talk? We don't have too much time left. I just want to talk about his time in Tunisia. And he said, in Tunisia, I had become aware of Rome, in Sicily of ancient Greece, and in Greece of Byzantium.
Mm-hmm.
Byzantium, in turn, led me to an enchanting realm of books that revealed how travel writing, rather than a low-rent occupation for the Sunday supplements, could also be a means to explore art, history, literature, and statecraft.
Right.
It was in Greece where I began to figure out how to make a living.
That's right.
What's the living?
Well, I think the living is as a correspondent, a commentator on world events, who is also a travel writer steeped in history, steeped in culture, and an understanding of what Lawrence Durrell, who's one of the great travel writers he talks about, refers to as the spirit of place. I mean, at the end of the book, he talks about an encounter he has with Patrick Leigh Fermor, who's a great travel writer and also a war hero undercover with the British forces in Greece during World War II. So I think that's where Kaplan really realizes he's found his métier.
And I want to give the last word to you as well, because while we were preparing for this chat, you sent me a link on the website to an article he had written in the Columbia Journalism Review, and it's called Cultivating mm-hmm. Loneliness. Mm-hmm. And I'll just quote one piece and then let you comment. The most dangerous thing a writer can do sometimes is to describe what he sees in front of his face, for the very ideals and assumptions that many of us live by are dependent upon maintaining a comfortable distance from the evidence. I'm going to put a link to this article up on the Talking Travel Literature webpage.
Good.
But just comment briefly on why you recommend this article for people.
Well, I think for anyone like myself who is an aspiring travel writer who is trying to develop my skills in this genre of writing, this is a really good how-to guide, because he makes some very important distinctions between sort of mass market journalism and the kind of insightful, informed travel writing he's trying to do. You really do need to immerse yourself in the history and the background of the place you visit, and try as much as possible. I know it's impossible to completely divest yourself of all of your preconceived ideas and impressions and beliefs, but you really have to open yourself up to the place you're at, the people you're talking to, and let yourself step in back a little bit to understand it and appreciate it better.
Thanks very much, Peter. And on the next Talking Travel Literature, what do you want to talk about?
There's a whole range. We could start with Robert Kaplan's bibliography, Bob, but I have some ideas in mind. But.
Well, actually, I have an idea. What do you think about The City of Falling Angels by John Berendt?
I think that's an excellent suggestion, Bob, and I believe we just had Mr. Berendt on the show not long ago.
That's right, so people can listen to him talk about his book as well. Okay, that's great, Peter. Then it's decided. The next one's going to be The City of Falling Angels, so stay tuned for another issue of Talking Travel Literature. Thanks again, Peter. We'll see you again.
Okay, Bob.